Right now, it's going to be my great pleasure to introduce to you Jason Santamaria. He is the creative director at Happy Cog. He is also the art director for A List Apart. And his presentation is Good Design Ain't Easy. Please give him a big welcome.
Thank you. Can you guys hear me? Is that all right? Loud? Yeah. All right. Good afternoon. Are your brains full yet? Are they just mushy, pulpy things at this point? Do you have a little bit more room, maybe? I'm going to try and go through this sort of quickly if I can, not only because I have a lot of information to cover and I'm determined to at least allow for maybe one question at the end of this, but also to kind of keep me awake. It seems to be about the time of day since I've been in New Zealand where I've needed to take a nap. So if I look like I'm waning or if I'm going to fall asleep, just throw something at me, yell, please, don't let me do it. So hello, I'm Jason Santamaria from the United States, creative director of Happy Cog Studios. And I want to start off today by actually changing my subject. Welcome, I'm not going to talk about what you thought I was. So what I had planned to talk about, Good Design Ain't Easy, is a little bit more on the production side of things, right? I wanted to talk about maybe how to use grids and typography and really creative ways to make your stuff look a little bit different than what else is out there. And while that's a great conversation to have and one that we definitely do need to have, I realized in researching this topic that it's sort of getting ahead of the point. What we need to start with, because there's this problem with this line of thinking, what we really need to start with is storytelling. What our designs are actually trying to say. There's a certain level of storytelling in all of the designs that we make, and not just storytelling alone, but storytelling with a plan. There's a plan that we set forth with our designs, and that reinforces the content that we're designing around. So perhaps maybe a more appropriate title for this talk would be something like The Design of Communication. Hi, I'm Jason Santamaria. Okay, so how does design actually tell a story? Well, from a very young age, we're kind of trained to look for stories within images. Before we know how to read, and before we kind of understand what text does when it's paired with an image, we kind of look to these images to find a narrative, to find some sort of thread. And we may not know exactly what's going on because we can't read that text, or maybe someone has to read it to us, but we can kind of infer the events that are going on. And this is really called graphic resonance, this idea that the imagery that is paired with the text is serving a point to support that text and to reinforce what's going on and to actually drive the narrative forward. How many of you had Ataris when you were little? Yeah, so this is a game called Haunted House. It's terrifying, right? Just to play this game is to look at fear in the face and laugh. And just looking at this, you can kind of see, all right, we have sort of like maybe a boomerang thing. There's the Provoke logo over here. And kind of like a meatball with eyes. There's a certain leap of faith that we have to make here in order to assume what's happening in this game. And a couple weeks ago, I was digging through some old books, and I found the old Atari catalog that I got with the system. And this is the artwork that would come with the games. This is the box art. And I realized, wow, how fascinating is this? Even though the technology wasn't there to really fully represent a ghost or a haunted house, this imagery, this painting, sort of fills in that gap. It tells the rest of the story. How awesome is that? Like, this is sort of creepy. Some bats, some really scary eyes, and a big spider. All right, now I'm scared. I'm ready to play this game. And I can fill in the rest of the story in my own mind. In this situation, the designer really becomes the narrator of that story. We're the ones who set forth to push the story forward and to tell it the way that the writing intends it to be told. And not only that, using things like graphic resonance and imagery to push that story up to a higher level. And I'm sure a lot of you have seen this graph before. It was really, this design before. It was sort of popularized by Edward Tufte, but he didn't design it, obviously. And I'm not going to explain it fully, but what this is really showing is Napoleon's march into Russia in 1812. And the important parts here, you see that kind of tan side over here? This is Poland, and this is Moscow over here. So starts out in on the border of Russia and Poland, and that width is equivalent to how many troops he has, right? So 1 millimeter equals like 10,000 troops. And you can see as he marches all the way over to Moscow, that line gets thinner and thinner. He's losing troops due to like starvation, the deadly winter, which is plotted along the bottom, and temperature. Once he gets to Moscow, he says, screw this, I'm going home. And now the line is black, and it's getting thinner and thinner and thinner. As he gets all the way back to Poland, look how many troops he has. I mean, this is telling such a dramatic, dramatic story of loss. This is the beauty of design right here. And this design is telling a very dramatic story. I was looking for other examples of this, and I stumbled across Wired. How many of you read Wired magazine? Big number. In print, maybe not the web, yeah. So if we look at this layout, we see it's about the sleazy life and nasty death of Russia's spam king. Ooh, this guy sounds fun. So we have this gigantic page of yellow, really obnoxious color, right? Something sort of distasteful. And over on the right side, we have this really gritty urban scene and an also yellow car kind of cropped out in a suspicious manner. We don't really know what's going on, but we know something's up. Something's not quite right. We're probably not supposed to like this guy. And this is all being done with the design. Before we even read this article, the design is setting the tone, and it's showing us what we should be thinking about when we're reading this article. This is the mood that it's setting. If this were an image of a beautiful grassy field with some flowers and maybe a nice sunset in the background, we would have a completely different impression of the spam king. Another example from Wired magazine. This is a article about Lonely Girl 15. Rose to prominence on YouTube. I'm sure you're all familiar with her. And just by looking at this, we kind of get the idea, okay, these guys are filming her. They made these videos with her. This is probably like a behind-the-scenes look about things. You get the idea that it's being reinforced about YouTube by this, not really a drop cap, but a drop word, sort of aping the YouTube logo. You kind of get an impression about what you're going to read, right? Wired does this really well. And actually, a lot of magazines end up doing this really well. This guy, we probably can like this guy. He's sort of presented in a really nice, forward, friendly manner. We get the full picture of him. But all of these stories are different stories, and the design is different because it's telling a different story. So each of these layouts looks different. This has different type treatments, different drop caps, different imagery. This is all setting the tone for what we're going to read. And this one, about why things suck with Sarah Silverman. I actually was going to take this out, but I ended up sitting next to the Wired editor on the plane over here randomly, and I wanted to keep it in here just for her. And this layout sort of sucks itself. Like, it's not a very good design, but it's sucking designerly-wise. I guess, like, it's sucking on purpose, if you want to go that far. Okay, so Wired magazine does a really good job of setting the tone with design, right? What happens when these things come online? Here's the sleazy life and nasty death of Russia's spam king. Wow, where did that mood go? Where's that big, bold yellow that we had? Am I supposed to like this guy? All the way down the page, just text. There's no impression of what this story is about. I had some thumbnail images, but what the hell? Here's the Lonely Girl story. Well, that looks very similar. It's telling the same exact story, in fact, with design. Even the Sarah Silverman one, I mean, not really doing much with the design and the layout, it's just sort of a screenshot from the magazine plopped on a page. What's wrong here? We've distilled our stories down to content. These aren't interesting things anymore, it's just text on a page. We knew how to design before. We had this capability in print. Why isn't it on the web? Where is it? Have any of you seen Helvetica, the documentary? It's very good. Yeah. So David Carson was interviewed in Helvetica, and David Carson is a designer who all at once sort of inspires a lot of hatred and a lot of love from graphic designers for his work in, you know, the late 80s, early 90s with Ray Gun magazine and sort of deconstructing graphic design, and he pissed a lot of people off, especially traditional graphic designers. But with all of that aside, he has this really great quote in Helvetica: "Design can't not communicate. No matter what you put down on a page, every line, every pixel, every absence of line or pixel is communicating something. We can't help it. It's part of the medium. Even Wired is communicating something. Maybe it's not the right story. Maybe it's the same story over and over again, but it's communicating something. But our stories are lacking. Where's the passion? Where's that yellow?" So we're all familiar with a lot of the Web 2.0 logos. And while these look all fun and lickable, this is just one small smattering of what's out there right now. And these are all using speech bubbles. Not only do they kind of look the same, they're using very similar elements. And they're all telling the same story. Just by looking at these, can you really tell one apart from another and tell me what one does better than another just by looking at them? Do you get an impression of anything? Our layouts are doing the same thing. Very, very similar looks to things, very similar feelings. We're telling very similar stories all the time, but with different content. So why are we actually plagued by this sameness? How many of you have heard stuff like this? Most web designers aren't actually graphic designers. No one's heard that? Oh, there you go. How many of you are graphic designers? Graphic designers. Yeah, a couple of you. How many of you make websites? Ooh, quite a few more, right? What about this? We're limited to only 5 typefaces. How on earth can we create great design with just 5 typefaces? It's not possible. You're mad. Get the hell off the stage. Okay. Yeah, but we're all capable of telling a story, just like we saw back when with the children's stories. We all know what a story is. It's part of our human nature to tell a story and to understand when other people are telling us stories. It's ingrained in us. And 5 typefaces, hell, in the dawn of printing, typefaces were limited. They were really expensive expenditures. Not only that, there were physical things that people had to upkeep and maintain and store. And they only had a handful of typefaces, and still, they're making gorgeous graphic design. These aren't limitations. These are constraints. We're designers. We work within constraints all the time. These are the things that shape our designs, these constraints. So are we just not trying hard enough? As silly as that sounds, are we not designing hard enough? Have we not put in enough hours? If we look at some sort of landmarks of graphic design, like Milton Glaser's Dylan poster, or Paul Rand's work with IBM, making one of the most boring companies on Earth look sort of intriguing. Paula Scherer's public theater posters in New York, really upbeat typography, nice, fun imagery, sort of lively, makes you feel like you want to dance. Vignelli's New York subway poster, Paramount, an isometric design. All of these examples were cited by Armin Witt from the popular design blog Speak Up, who in this article where he cites these, he also says, "When it comes to websites, I can't think of a single www that could be comparable in gravitas, praise, or memorability to any of those designs." Why the hell is that? I mean, we all start at square one, right? We all have ideas. We all know how to use programs. We know how to design and communicate. We all start with a blank canvas. It doesn't matter if it's a book or a browser window. Why don't our designs look that good? I like to think it's a bigger issue. I like to think that it's actually something to do with the medium. The actual nature of the medium is what's separating things like print design from web design. This isn't a small issue. And though I think we know about a lot of these things, we don't consider them. We've been looking at web design through the lens of print. And the way that we define good graphic design online is by looking at what good graphic design looks like in print. And this is very wrong. Very wrong. Common principles can no longer be taken for granted, that we take for granted in design. Some of which, and not all, but some of the ones that I want to talk about today are these. I'm going to go into more detail of each of these. Metaphorical page. What do I mean by the metaphorical page? So, long, long ago, I mean, we were using things, not necessarily paper pages, but we were using canvases, right? Whether it's a cave wall or something else, we're using a physical medium to convey our stories and to convey our ideas. Whether it's a cave wall, something man-made, maybe a pillar of stone, before we even had characters to describe words, we were painting pictures, we were drawing pictures in the same way we did when we were kids. And as this evolves, we start coming up with characters and different ways to convey our stories on these pages. Into the printing press, modern printing, up to modern layout, more modern things. All of this is very similar. We're all dealing with physical means and telling those stories on the physical mediums. Stick with me, I know this is a long quote. So the average man of today must struggle to accomplish such basic objectives as being able to read signs, identify products, digest advertisements, or locate information in newspapers, books, and catalogs. There is an urgent need for communication based upon precision and clarity. Well, that sounds like what we do every day, right? We have so much information to convey on websites, copyright information, logos, author information, articles, all this crap that we have to get on one page. This is said by a designer in 1964 named Ladislav Sutnar, well before the modern web was anything. These aren't new problems at all that we're dealing with. I mean, we still have loads of information to fit on a page, lots of different types of information. And they had these issues back then. Before they had these new problems that we have on the web, people still had to find that information quickly. And the main means to do that was obviously the page. But new needs are requiring new solutions. We need to shake up the way that we're even thinking about what a page is. The same designer, Ladislav Sutnar, originated a two-page spread. I know what you're thinking, like, two-page spread. All right, I see a magazine, and something takes up both pages. It's essentially made two pages into one. It seems really obvious, right? For this guy, no one was doing it. No one thought to do it. People were considering pages separate entities. No one had considered, why don't I just have this line go across the other page? Look at all, there's a whole lot more space over here still. And these are some examples of what he was doing. This is revolutionary. No one had considered it. So even though no one had considered it, he's still opening up new doors in a medium that people thought was completely static. There's not going to be any more innovations in magazines. We have our two pages. There's stuff over here, and there's stuff over here. We're done. And still, there's innovation in that. Obviously, on web pages, we have different constraints. Some of these are length and viewpoint. And what exactly do I mean by this? Well, if we take a book off of any one of our bookshelves, which I'm sure you all have this book as well, this has fixed constraints, right? It has a width, it has a height, and we can look at it. We can see how big it is. Looking at a web page, we have lots of information on the New York Times homepage, but how big is the New York Times homepage? Is it always the same, like the book? No. More information means bigger page. Simple. Pages can extend off infinitely in all directions. There is no limitation to how big a page can be. And there's no definition of how big a page is. Not only that, even though a page can extend off in all directions, we're only able to see a small portion of this. We have a small window into the world of the web, if you will. A book we can sort of absorb all at once. We can see how big it is. End of story. This is a pretty gigantic constraint. And this constraint, I would say, gives us a lot of license to talk. We can put as much as we want on a page. It doesn't matter. There's plenty of room. Throw it down there. Put an ad over there. Big whoop. Loads of room. Additionally, we have this ideal of all in one. What do I mean by that? If we look at a book, we might have a cover, and the information on the cover, author info, title of a book, logos, stuff like that. We might have copyright information, table of contents, maybe an index in the back, and then the back cover. Maybe advertisements, promotions, things about the book, other stuff about the author. All right, that content's paced out over the course of an entire book. Online, of course, we have to have everything on one page. You need to be able to get to all of this information at the same time, at any time. So we have things like logos, author information, articles, navigation for table of contents, all the way down the page, loads of content, down to the copyright, eventually. There it is. All of this on one page. It's very different than the way that we have to do these things in print. Ubiquity and WYSIWYG, what you see is what you get. So New York Times, when a designer, one of the designers at the Times designs the paper, it goes from them to the printer, into the deliverer's hands, and then into the reader's hands, and it doesn't change. The design stays intact the entire way, and it's exactly the way that the designer intended it to be. That message is unchanged. Of course, online, we can resize type, we can get rid of images, get rid of CSS, we can reflow content, we can do whatever the hell we want to a page. In fact, sometimes pages restructure themselves on the fly when we're using them. This is Sean Inman, a designer's old site. You can't really see it, but on the slide, there's a tab at the very top, and when you click on it, this happens. Now the scope of this page has changed entirely. When I'm looking at the New York Times, I can't take some of the sports stories that I want and throw them onto the front page of the paper, and then maybe bring like the crossword over into the second page of the paper. I can't do anything with the paper. It's exactly the way that it was delivered to me. Whereas online, things change. Things can be adjusted. Things can be rearranged to the way that I want them or to the way that the author wants them. Collections of pages. Once again, if we look at a book or a magazine, just by looking at it, you can kind of get an idea of what you're in for. You can kind of see how much info is on a page. You can kind of understand the amount of text that you're going to have to contend with. You can see, all right, there's like 200 pages. This is going to take me a couple hours to read. I can look at the New York Times and say, this is going to take me an afternoon to read. I get that. Just by looking at it, there's a certain amount of attainability and grasp of depth within that. Online, if we look at this again, look, there's navigation by decade, by year, by month. There's department pages. I have no idea how big this site is. And there's no way to tell. There could be some pages that have an article that's 200 words long. There could be other pages that have a video that's an hour long. There's no way for me to tell how long it will take me to digest the site. And lastly, one of the biggest ones, layout. So one of the common principles that I was talking about that we can no longer take for granted is a layout principle. How many of you are familiar with the golden ratio? Yeah, good number. Okay, so golden ratio, also known as 1:1:1.618, is something that we sort of take for granted, obviously, in the print world. And a lot of print and like book design is based upon ratios like this. This ratio in particular is called the golden section, the golden ratio, the divine ratio, because it's found so often in nature. Things like pine cones or nautilus shells or even the human body are based off of ratios very close to this. And what I mean by that is if you look at the ratio of, say, finger segments on your finger as they are to the arm, there's a very similar amount of length according to this ratio. And this ratio has sort of magical properties. If you were to fold this in half, you end up with a smaller piece, but a piece that has the same exact ratio. And that ratio carries on those same qualities. So it can be folded in half again and again and again and again into infinity. And what this allows someone to do as a designer, if they employ something like this ratio or other ratios, it allows them to sort of inject a systematic sameness across the design. It creates this cohesive whole to a design. So you can base a width of a page off of this ratio, and that scales down to the width of a text column, which scales down to a drop cap or an image size or a text size. Everything is based off of one ratio, and it creates this sort of nice sameness. Another principle, rule of thirds. Very, very simple principle. Divide your canvas into thirds in horizontal and vertical, and you end up with sort of a grid like this. And this is kind of shorthand for providing interest. The rule of thirds basically says that anything in your picture that you can sort of align to one of these lines, or especially an intersection of one of these lines, provides visual interest. It's just shorthand, right? Really simple rule, but very profound. If this boat were sitting right in the middle, and the ground wasn't right along that line, it wouldn't feel as interesting. Lining it up like this provides tension and energy and a little bit of interest. But of course, these things rely on a certain canvas that we can define. Everything that we use now, browsers, screen sizes, Kindle, iPhones, these all have different canvases, canvases that we can't define. So the ratio and the rule of thirds don't really apply in the same ways anymore. Because these design ideals rely on fixed dimensions. And as we all know, most of the web runs on a single fixed dimension, that's width. And even that's sort of questionable. We can define a width for our pages, but it might not be the same everywhere. And we definitely can't define a height in the same way. I mean, if we decide that our page is going to be yay wide, and according to that golden ratio, we want it to be yay tall, we can't really define that. Because our content needs to define that, and the content's going to look different everywhere. So this is what I mean by looking at design online through the lens of print. It's just not possible. The reason that we don't see great designs like, you know, the Paul Scher stuff or the Paul Rand IBM stuff is because we're dealing with a very different medium. Just because we're designing online does not mean that this is the same way that we designed in print. And to call the same thing online bad design just because it doesn't look as simple or it doesn't fall in line with all these design ideals that were largely based in print, doesn't mean that it's bad. At the end of the day, we're telling stories, right? It doesn't matter that it isn't a fixed width or a fixed height. We should be looking at what the design is saying. There's a message that we're missing. So I have some examples here of things that I think are telling really good stories. And these aren't necessarily the greatest stories that are being told online. They aren't necessarily implicative of the greatest designs online, but these are approaches. These are people who are doing something a little bit different and telling a unique story. There's a site that went up a little while ago called No One Belongs Here More Than You, which is the partner site for a book by the same name written by Miranda July, who's also a performance artist, and she did a movie, and she's fantastic. And the site is just simply this. Right there. All right, so just looking at this, it's an image with an arrow. I have no way to find out information about the author, no way to buy the book, no copyright information, nothing. I can't even see the book yet. But I kind of want to click. Immediately, one click in, I'm drawn into the story. Who the hell is this woman? Why can't she even afford a dry erase board? Why is she writing, picturing her on top of her refrigerator, writing on this refrigerator just to take pictures for this site? It's hilarious. It's a really engrossing story, and already I'm getting sort of a picture of what this person's about, and maybe I'm already interested in what this book is about. And the site goes on for like 30 more frames, and there's only one path through it. It's just linear. I can't jump to any of these other frames. And she goes from talking about other books to realizing that she can't really erase that well on top of her refrigerator, so she moves over to her stove. I mean, it's fantastic. So simple. This goes against most of what we consider great design online, you know, being able to hop around like the Harper site. Not that the Harper site is bad, but this is very different. But it's so engrossing. How many of you are familiar with Frey? Frey's been online for like a decade. The internet was like built around Frey. It was there before then. Frey is a website, or at least it used to be a website like this. These are some old screens of Frey, where people can write stories and then they pair them together with an illustrator or some sort of artist who comes up with layouts for the stories and provides like visual interest to it. So this is written by Derek Pawazek, who was the founder of Frey. And this is a story about him coming to terms with being Jewish and not really wanting to have his bar mitzvah. So he takes this teddy bear that his dad gave him and he stabs it, and then he ends up stabbing himself in the leg. And it's a very, very sort of harrowing story for a child. But it's sort of interesting, even the visual style of this. We have different layouts and kind of feels like a storybook. And this sort of childlike illustrations, it's really, really interesting. It kind of draws you in. And here's another one. It's called The Worm Within. And this is a story. So a guy gets a tapeworm from eating beef, right? And this is a story about him having to like deal with passing the tapeworm, I guess you could say. So that's the narrator there, and he has his pants down because the story takes place, him narrating it from a toilet. And we can see, you know, there's some really interesting images happening here, some really graphic sort of stuff, but it draws you in. There's some really beautiful color and different type and layouts happening here, you know, all the way to the end. And you're kind of with the author the whole time. There's a good story going on here. And one of the best things about Frey, and you can kind of see it down here in the bottom, there's always a call to action for you to provide your own story. So if you had a tapeworm, I guess you could provide your own story about it. But they're always different, and this one's great. What's lived in you? Exactly. So Frey's still online, but it's taken different forms now. They've moved on to like a printed magazine, but they still publish some of the stuff online. And this is their new site, and the first issue of Frey is about busted, being caught. So being caught like red-handed. And this is even sort of attempting to have like the rule of thirds horizontally. We can see that, but obviously we know that that's not gonna go all the way down the page. Those of you who were in Liz Danzico's session earlier probably saw a little bit about a brief message. A brief message is a really simple goal. Design op-ed, 200 words or less. Really simple, interesting constraints. And each time, the layout sort of adapts to the story that's being told. Each illustration is a little bit different in different ways to support that content. The content reflows around the images in interesting ways. And still, we kind of have this interesting wrapper, the shell of the site, but the design is adaptive to the story that's being told, and the illustrations are there to support that story. And sometimes there isn't an illustration at all, but the design of the site takes over to support the story in a different way. So this is a story about white space, and the whole site goes black. It's fascinating. Really simple, subtle things, but telling powerful stories to go with the content. Principles of Beautiful Web Design. This is a book by a guy named Jason Beard. And this book is sort of, I think he sort of builds this as like web design for developers. He breaks down a lot of really basic concepts about design, color usage, and things like that. And just looking at the site, all right, it's kind of interesting, big book, little hand-done stuff. It looks pretty standard, but as you start interacting with it, it tells a very different story. The site becomes a subject itself. And the site starts calling attention to different elements. Oh, I use this color here, this is an image, this is a GIF. Points, lines, textures, things like that. It starts telling a story about the design of the site itself. That's great. That's me. So my site, I've always sort of considered myself kind of like a blue-collar graphic designer. I've never been like a real kind of heady theoretical type, I guess. And you can't entirely see it, but over there there's more to the site. It kind of looks like a paperback book. That's been really heavily read, really used, and sort of loved, I guess you could say. And this really feels like me, and I think that people who know me will think that this feels like me too. Come October every year, I get really into Halloween, and I love horror movies and reading about horror books and stuff like that. So every Halloween, I sort of make over my site a little bit to go with the theme of the month. So this time, you know, there's some blood and fingerprints, I guess. Someone died reading my site violently. The next year after that, it's sort of themed after Edgar Allan Poe, and it kind of feels like a Gothic work. And after that, maybe H.P. Lovecraft, and it feels sort of Victorian and very black and heavy and moody. All of these things are kind of telling a story about me and about my site and about what I'm into. And not only that, they're adapting to whatever is going on at that time. It's a great segue into immaturity, my sight into immaturity. So really, the web is a very immature medium. I mean, we kind of say these things, and we understand the web isn't print. We say this stuff all the time. But how much have we actually thought about it? What are the real differences? And that's why I actually ended up changing this talk, because I realized it isn't about pixels and grids and shit like that, necessarily. It's just about something much bigger. And not to belittle that. I mean, Dan Cederholm's going to talk about this stuff tomorrow, and I feel bad now. He's going to blow your mind. So this is the very first photograph that was ever taken. I believe it took like half a day to expose. And what it's actually of, it's sort of a rooftop, I believe, in France. And it's not really important right now what it's about. But when photography was popularized, or when it was attempting to become popular, people didn't really get it. The uptake wasn't very quick. And the way that photographers would describe it is they would say that these images were written with light. That's so beautiful, written with light. It's just poetic. And what they were doing is sort of taking it back to something that we all understand. Like I said, we all get stories. We understand these stories that are being told. And these images, they're just a different kind of story. And we've written them with light. So these innovations make new information available to the masses. Before photography was being used like this, people would have to pay a lot of money to get their portrait painted. But this brought more a newer kind of record-keeping to the people. When Gutenberg popularized the printing press, right before him, if you wanted to get a Bible, if you could even read, if you wanted to get a Bible, you would have to wait a decade, maybe two decades, for a monk to pen the Bible for you by hand. Gutenberg brought the Bible to the masses. Literacy skyrocketed once people could afford the Bible, too. But it was a lot cheaper than the penned ones by the monks. But these innovations have brought this information that was inaccessible from these people to the masses. And that's a pretty big deal. I feel like we're doing that a lot now. When Henry Ford came out with the Model T, and I'm sure we've all heard this, people can have the Model T in any color they want as long as it's black. He had figured out a lot of different ways to improve processes, right? Better ways to make the car, more efficient ways, better tools to use, better materials. He'd figure out all the tough stuff, all the technical stuff before the color stuff. Like, it wasn't about design back then. It was, you know, does it work? Is it going to explode? I feel like a lot of what we're doing right now on the web is that black car. You know, we've done incredible things. We've gotten down, things like CSS. We get it. You know, we're starting to understand so much more about accessibility. Everyone is. We've made all of these advancements in the technical side of things. But I feel like we still have this black car. Eventually, once people started to get the car and they started buying more, then there's red and there's other colors. I feel like it's time for us to start looking for those stories again. Design for the web has really chiefly been driven forward by technology rather than message. We know how to do a lot of stuff and make stuff move and make stuff adapt, but what are the messages that we have? In reality, the form of design should drive the form of the story. The story needs to come back into all of this. Some photography credits. Thank you. I think we have some time for questions. How about that? Does anyone have questions? Jump up and down if I, yeah? Yeah, you. Yes, shout it out. Right. Okay. So is that... All right, so the nature of the medium is such that timeliness plays a large factor. We can't always be making sure everything's accessible if the design's always changing and stuff like that. So you can see with some of this stuff, I don't think the design always needs to change, even the cite a brief message. The design doesn't change that drastically, but it changes enough to support the story in a different way. I mean, we pay people to code pages, right? And we pay people to make sure they're accessible. Why aren't we paying people to art direct these pages as well? You know, that's just another part of the story. I don't think that it's impossible, I just don't think that we're doing it. You know, we manage to separate our presentation from our structure, right? I think that a lot of our pages get spit out of a CMS, and we use these templates over and over again. I think that we need to separate the design from the CMS again, you know? I agree, it is very tough. I'm not disputing that, but I'm saying it's something. I mean, we fought for so much in this community, tooth and nail, on how to get browsers to implement things, you know, better accessibility guidelines, better accessibility support. We fought for so much. We need to keep fighting for this good stuff. Any other questions? Do the stories need to come from people with design backgrounds? No, like I said, absolutely not. We're all capable of telling a story. And even some of the stuff, I mean, the design wasn't that incredible, but it's telling a different story, you know? There's something to it. You can't always point out exactly what it is in a design or in the way that something's written, but you can feel it, you know? There's something there, there's a story there, and I don't think that, you know, it takes a design degree to be able to tell that story. I don't think that it takes necessarily that kind of training. Like I said, when we're all kids, we understand what stories are, and we kind of get it when someone's telling us a story. We like to tell our own stories. We like to share our experiences. This happens all the time online with, you know, a lot of the social sites as well. Yeah? Do I have any sites or books that I use to gain inspiration? I'm a huge bibliophile, and half of the reason that my site looks like a book. And I read as much design backlog of books as I can, lots about typography. So I read, you know, obviously the basics like Elements of Typographic Style by Robert Bringhurst, Thinking with Type by Ellen Lupton, which you saw up there. I'm always reading about typographic stuff, especially the history of typefaces. So type, the reason I'm saying all this, type really plays a big part in my inspiration. I love working with typography, and I love discovering new typefaces or rediscovering old typefaces and finding different ways to use them. So a lot of my inspiration comes from that, but photography. I actually try not to look too much online for inspiration because I feel like it's too close to what I'm already doing, and I feel like there's a much bigger chance that I could just copy whatever's going on, whether I know it or not. It's just like, wow, this person solved this idea really well. Why am I going to reinvent what they did, you know? It just makes sense to keep going with what they had. So I try to get away from the computer and draw inspiration from other stuff. Anyone else? I know everyone's beat. Oh, way in the back. Can someone pass that up? Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Is that a question? Yes. Well, I sort of generalized the golden section, that ratio that I was talking about. But basically what he's saying is the sum of those two sides produces, oh God, let me think of this. A plus B equals B to AB. Is that it? I know it in my head. I don't know why I have so much trouble describing this thing. If you add up those two sides, whatever their measurements are going to be, that value and the larger value from before produce the same ratio. The square of each time. Thank you. Yes? Anyone else? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do I think that there's too much emphasis on placing everything on one page all the time? Well, I don't know. I think certain types of content need it. You know, Harper's, that makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of information on Harper's, a lot of good stuff, and you do need to be able to get to it in an easy way. And I'm sure Peter Morville could probably have a much more eloquent response for this question. But I think different types of content work out better, like the book site. There's a very clear goal in mind there. You know, it's not a huge thing. She wants you to learn a little bit about her, learn about the book, hopefully buy the book. You know, there isn't a whole lot of depth of content there, but the content that's there is really interesting. She could have done that really straight up and just provided, like, about the author, buy the book, excerpt from the book, you know, stuff like that. And that's fine. It serves its purpose, too, but it's definitely not as interesting. Again, yeah. Is there anything I'm worried about with the Web 2.0 design stuff? I guess what I'm most worried about is people sort of feeling like that .com thing again, like just because you think that a community will form around an idea, you think that it's, that, you know, you throw all of these resources at it and it's a fantastic venture, and then it flops. Like, you know, not everything needs to have a community around it. And not only that, I feel like in the same way those logos looked, I feel like there's a lot of aping going on in the Web 2.0 community. You know, dropping vowels, making your R pink, and I don't know. People are just looking for the easy answers. And I don't think that storytelling is really that hard, but it's definitely more effort, and, you know, there's more effort involved in getting there. Are we good? Anyone? All right, I think that's it. Thank you very much. Thank you.